Let me say a few words about the shiur tonight. Tonight I'm going to try to gain an insight in the events which are described in the Megillah, in Megillah's Esther. I'm mainly concerned with the human role in history as reflected by Megillah's Esther, and I'm also concerned in the distinctive roles which men and women, male, female, play in the historical drama. In order to achieve this objective, I'll have to interpret certain passages in the Megillah. What I'm going to say will be very simple, even though very long. The Megillah contains the story of events which occurred at a twilight hour in Jewish history. It marks the passing of a bright, beautiful summer day, full of song and color and joy. Couldn't they keep quiet over there? I don't know where it is. A day on which God's word was on many tongues and his spirit in many hearts. It marks the passing of the summer day. It also marks the approaching of a dark, dreary, autumnal night of silence and fear. A night in the course of which God stopped speaking to his people. The covenantal community at that hour of twilight was losing, slowly but surely, the most precious of all its gifts, namely prophecy. The great covenantal dialogue between man and God, which commenced with Abraham, was about to be terminated. And the prophetic community faced a stark and ruthless reality, a non-prophetic existence, for which the Jew was not prepared at all. Of course, with the transition from a prophetic to a non-prophetic community, the Jewish historical experience changed considerably. The events which were recorded in the Megillah are differently arranged already and differently interconnected than, let us say, the events surrounding Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus, as reported in the Book of Exodus. These two sets of events, the set of events of Egypt and the set of events of Shushan HaBiroch, differ in two respects. First, as regards the theology and causal nexus. While the Megillah occurrences fit perfectly into the framework of normal historical causality, the occurrences in Egypt preceding the Exodus belong to a meta-historical, indeed metaphysical order of things and events. This is number one. a different causality, a different etiology, with two different frames of reference. Second, the role of man has assumed, with the emergence of the non-prophetic community, new dimensions. To be sure, in both epochs, God used man as the instrument of implementation. Man has always been the so-called, it's Maimonidean expression, Shliach Hokeil, the messenger of God, God's plenipotentiary, or ambassador on earth. Mordecai himself proclaimed this doctrine that man is the Shliach Hokeil in his famous message he sent to Esther, Nevertheless, there is a basic discrepancy between the shlichus entrusted to Moses and that assigned to Mordechai. The mission with which Moses was charged was precisely defined. There was no alternative but to act in a strictly prescribed manner. Moses did not enjoy the freedom of decision and action. He received specific instructions what to do and how to act. Take just an example. Daber al bnei Yisrael v'yizor. V'ato horem esmatcho al hayom. Tnu lochem, tnu usu lochem, tzofeino, etc., etc. In contrast to this kind of shliches, Mordechai received not a clearly defined, but a multifaceted mandate. It was left to him how to interpret and implement this mandate. Mordecai was confronted with a number of alternatives. The choice was his. He exercised free judgment and free evaluation. In Egypt, God acted, basically. Man was an onlooker. We will say in the Rabbani pretty soon. Bavarti v'eretz Mitzrayim b'laylo. Hazeh v'ikeshti kopcher v'eretz Mitzrayim. Ani v'lei maloch. Ani v'lei sorof. Ani hu v'lo ha-shaliach. Meishu was the shaliach, the messenger, but his role was confined in Egypt to a mechanical performance. In Persia, and this is typical of the entire era of non-prophetic Judaism, God summoned men to act. He gave him a mandate to act, but he did not define or formulate the mandate. He told men to act freely and wisely, of course, under God's supervision and a watchful eye. What man enjoyed and still enjoys, full freedom. Of course, God is in communication with man in both eras, in the prophetic as well as in the non-prophetic era. However, the nature of the communication is not the same. In the prophetic era, as I said before, the communication was clear and understandable. While in the non-prophetic era, the communications, the divine communications which reached men, were very laconic and enigmatic, consisting of mysterious hints and signs, bright dazzling flashes and intimations that mystified man. The latter quite often in the non-prophetic era, when freedom of action was granted him, felt very lonely and forsaken. Man in the non-prophetic era is from time to time, erroneously, under the impression as if God has abandoned and deserted him. A frightening silence envelops everybody and everything in the non-prophetic era. There is a very strange passage, a Talmudic passage, in whom the Talmud asks a very strange question. Esther minateiro minai. Where is the name of Esther mentioned in the Pentateuch? Strange question. And the answer was given immediately. It is mentioned, indeed. Where was it mentioned? Ve'onechi Aster Aster Ponai by Yom Ahu, and I shall hide my countenance on that day of silence. What did the Talmud mean to express by this question and this answer? I believe a very simple thought. The Pentateuch tells us the story of the prophetic community, of course. All five books tell us the story of the prophetic community. At the hour of triumph, at the hour of universal revelation and direct contact with God. The Pentateuch tells us the story of Moses and the community he led. But what kind of a message does the Pentateuch have for the non-prophetic community? At an hour not of triumph, but at an hour of defeat and distress. Where is there in the Torah an allusion to the silent, mute confrontation between mighty historical events, invincible, almost invincible historical forces, and the Jew, both in the Promised Land and in the diaspora? Where is there a hint in the Torah about the struggle between a wicked prime minister, powerful, sly, and a lonely Jewish girl, a lonely Jewish poor girl, on whose frail shoulders Providence placed the heavy load of historical responsibility? About the struggle between a wicked prime minister, powerful, sly, and a lonely Jewish girl. Jewish poor girl, on whose frail shoulders Providence placed the heavy load of historical responsibility. The question in the Talmud, Esther Manat Romanai, is a simple one. How can the Jew triumph over his adversaries and enemies if God stopped speaking to him? If the messages he receives are quite often illegible and incomprehensible. And the answer to this question was more a statement of fact rather than an explanation. Even during the non-prophetic era, at a time when the countenance is hidden, man is elected by God to carry out, to make decisions, to undertake difficult tasks courageously, and to implement them superbly. Of course, it's a superhuman task for a young, inexperienced girl to stand up against a powerful, wicked prime minister. However, the Ruach HaKodesh, the Spirit of God, will descend on her and inspire her to defy danger and to make the right decisions. God asks of man to reach maturity and independence. He wills man to act with courage and wisdom, to be his own master. The Onsobei, Ashiru Aziz, the song of the Torah, will never be terminated. All communities, prophetic and non-prophetic, will join in. So, Mordechai and Esther were perhaps the first representatives of a non-prophetic community. A community in the diaspora, dispersed over a large territory, which was suddenly faced with a menace of mountainous proportions. Providence selected as the Shlichei Kehil, and I'm going to call them like that, as the Shlichei Kehil, as the messengers of God, not only Mordechai, but Esther as well. God apparently willed that both male and female appear as the actors on the historical stage. He removed himself from the stage. He wanted men to take his place. Judaism has never discriminated, and I want you to know I'm not trying to somehow to find grace in the eyes of the women's lead. As a matter of fact, I didn't intend to analyze the role of Esther and that of Mordechai. But somehow I got involved and I had to carry out my task, which was placed upon my frail shoulders by that story. Judaism has never discriminated against the women. As far as history making is concerned, I'm qualifying my statement. But the most important part, our most important task assigned to man is not to be counted as the 10th person in man, but to make history. And as far as history is concerned, Yahadus has never discriminated against the woman. From the days of Sarah, the woman was on par with man as a history maker. And perhaps at certain times, the times of crisis, the woman who was contributed more than man. The third phrase in the Pentateuch, which we read every Rosh Hashanah, Kila Shatimar Alecho Soro Shma Bekemo, has never been forgotten by the Jewish community. Both Mordecai and Esther were created in the image of God, no doubt about it. Both were endowed with dignity and majesty. Both possessed great talents. Both were charismatic personae. And both were called, what shall I say, using colloquialism, to the colors when disaster was about to strike. And both were summoned to make history. Of course, the statement that God assigned equally important roles to Mordechai and Esther, because both of them were metaphysically and spiritually worthy of the task, must not be misunderstood. The assignments were equal in importance, no doubt about it. And perhaps, as we'll see later, Esther's assignments transcended that of Mordecai, as far as historical significance is concerned. No doubt about it, they were equal in importance, but by no means identical. The assignments differed because there is, and I'm sorry to say that, but it is true and it is the opinion of Yehudas, because there is a basic differentiation of the sexes, not only physiologically, but psychically. I don't say psychologically, I say psychically and spiritually as well. It cannot be denied. A historical masculine role cannot be assigned to the woman, and vice versa, a feminine task must not be imposed upon man. In spite of the distinct roles which were assigned to Mordecai and Esther, they both collaborated beautifully. They were inseparable. We always start Alanisim, B'mei Mordechai v'Esther. Could have said B'mei Mordechai. As a matter of fact, the Goyen has eliminated B'mei Esther, but we didn't accept his opinion. We could say B'mei Mordechai. No, this would be unjust and unfair. They both played, the roles of both were complementary. And when you mention one, the other name should go along. Now, before I want to investigate the role of Esther and the role of Mordechai, distinct roles, but equally important, I want just to ask another question. Who actually are those Shluchei Okeil, those individuals whom God has chosen to implement His will and to act as His representatives in both eras, in the prophetic and the non-prophetic as well? Who are those? Who are they? Who are those charismatic personae elected by God to be history makers, and with whom, with those Shluchei Okeil, Jewish history is populated, is replete? from Abraham to Moses, and from Moses to Isaiah, and from Isaiah to Rabbi Akiva, and from Rabbi Akiva to Maimonides, and from Maimonides to the Ari, and from the Ari to the Baal Shem Tov, and etc., etc. Who were these cryptic figures? Who were they? These mysterious cryptic figures who played their roles so well, with determination and self-effacement, humbly and yet consistently, played the role and disappeared. Those figures, from Abraham down, have always intrigued me, always stimulated my curiosity. You were not simple people, should you say so? Just simple people? They were different. Of course, we have to say they were different. However, let me ask you, in what way different? Let us gaze at them for a while. Mordecai, to examine Mordecai as an individual, who was most probably an elderly Jew by the time those events which were recorded in Megillah occurred. He was, again, I mean, it's just a hypothetical statement on my part, he was most probably the son of a poor immigrant. He himself most probably was born in Shushan or in Persia, because Minagilo Asher Hegron and Nebuchadnezzar, and don't forget it was at the close of the 70 years, so it's almost an impossibility that Mordechai was born in Eretz Israel and was exiled to Shushan or to Babylonia and spent 70 years there before he became prime minister to Ahasuerus. I don't believe Ahasuerus would have appointed an old Jew, I mean, to the office of prime minister. He was most probably a son of poor immigrants, poor exiles. No one knew of his existence. No one cared to know of his existence, of the Ish Yehudi. What role could the Ish Yehudi play in the capital of Persia? What kind of a role? He lived in anonymity. And yet, we read in the Megillah, of course, but to understand Megillah, I would advise you to read the Megillah in private, not in a shul where Homan's name, I mean, whenever you mention Homan, I mean, there's banging and noise making. And yet we read in the Megillah that when Mordechai cried, a loud and bitter cry, the Jews throughout the empire cried with him. Ve'izak zokogdil el moro, mocholir le'ir, ve'kei mashadvar ha'melach ve'dosei magia, ve'vogodil ha'yudim, ve'tzei mufchi yumispet. Shushan was perplexed and in despair when Mordechai cried, "Ve'yir Shushan ha'echo." On the contrary, the Megillah tells us that when Mordechai suddenly appeared, to the surprise of everybody, on the streets of Shushan, clothed in purple and velvet, with a crown of gold on his head, the whole city was delirious with joy. Shushan, so how love is Samecho. Something strange comes to my mind while reading about those episodes and meditating about the mysterious bond between Mordecai and the people. I'm afraid to say, Mordecai is not just an individual, or no? Not just a single person, or no? He's more than that. So what was he? What is he? He was not individual, he was a people, a nation. Isn't it almost crazy? Isn't it pure nonsense? Absurd? Can an individual turn into a people? A single person into a nation? One man into a community? A weak woman into a great kingdom of priests? And a holy nation? Is it possible? Or this thought is crazy? I don't know. All I know is that Judaism held the view that it is not absurd. It is possible. Not only possible, it happened many times. Let us take a look. God reached a covenant with Abraham. It is self-evident that God was not concerned with an individual, no matter how great. No matter how holy. God was concerned with a people, with a community, which he willed to enter into a covenantal relationship with him. So if this be the case, why was God satisfied with Abraham? Now let us take a look at Moses. God sent Moses to take the Jews out of Egypt. He stated distinctly, the Almighty stated distinctly, that he was concerned with a people, as Am Ibnei Yisrael, with my people, the children of Israel. And yet, after the episode of the eagle, he told Moses, Psalacho, Psalacho, Shnei Luches Avonim. He addressed himself only to Moses. And the second revelation, in contrast with the first revelation, was a strictly private affair, or a private rendezvous between the God and Moses. The Yishal Yalimo, we'll read it tomorrow. The Gam Yishal Yiro, the Cholor Ahu. And no man shall come up with thee, neither let any man be seen throughout all the mount. In short, the second tablet, or the Torah, who was given to Moses exclusively, not to the people. How did the people receive the Torah? So the Gemara gives the answer. Moses was generous and passed it on to the people. What the Talmud meant to say by that is that Moshe personified 600,000 Jews. The individual turned into a people, into a nation. Of course it is, as I said before, it's a strange metamorphosis. Of course it is a frightening equation. An individual equals a people. But it is a Talmudic equation, Shaku Keneged. It is a mysterious identity, and yet Yahadus believed in such a possibility, in the merger of the I with the multitude. The individual becomes the abode of the millions. And if the individual can prepare within himself an abode for God, the infinite and eternal, we also limit us, we shachanti b'seichom. If the individual can accommodate God within the depth and recesses of his personality, he certainly can invite the millions, the same individual, millions of people, but there are finite people, to abide in him. And that's exactly what Moses, Abraham, and other Shluchei Rakeil did. Judaism thought very highly of the individual in history, no doubt about it. Judaism is opposed to the Marxist view or the view of Spengler. And other philosophers of history, the individual plays no role in history, only the crowd, the masses, the collective. Judaism thought that the individual is a history major. But in contradistinction to Thomas Carlyle, Judaism did not glorify the individual as such. Never made a hero and a semi-god of him, of the individual. Instead, Judaism brought forth a new identity, individual hyphen people. The individual is hyphenated with the people. Single person, hyphen many. Lonely man, hyphen community. And God addresses himself to such awesome and strange personalities. He deals with them. He reaches covenants with them. And he establishes relationships with them. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Aaron, David. They were not just individuals. They were individuals in whom millions were abiding. Interesting is that our sages said, Moshe lament, Moses did not die. David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. We all say it, repeat it, every month. Yaakov lament. All those individuals, peoples, an individual is a people, individuals are people. All those individuals in whom a multitude abides, all those individuals who merge with the community, in whom millions reside, do not die. Those individuals, they live forever. I wish to introduce just a saying by Rabbi Udali, which will cast a light upon what I just said. The Chover, you know, the Kuzari, is supposedly a record, a story of a debate, of a great debate, which took place many hundreds of years ago in the palace of the Melech HaKuzarim, of the king of the Khazars, between the Chover, it means the Jewish rabbi, as they translate it into English, because rabbi, most probably Chover, most probably scholar, and representative of Christianity, and also a representative of Islam. It was a long debate. But there the Chaver, the Jew, somehow said something which is perhaps the most important statement in the whole book. He said, Yisroel Shebeumot, Kelev Shebeivorim, Rav Poli v'Rav Brit. Israel, I don't mean it, I mean the Jewish people, among the nations is like the heart amidst the organs. It is the most sick and the most healthy of them all. Then he goes on to describe the function of the heart. Of course, it's described in terms of medieval medicine. The heart is visited without interruption by all sorts of diseases, as sadness, anxiety, envy, wrath, enmity, love, hate, and fear. It means there's no need to say that the heart is the seat of the human personality or the center of human emotional life. There's no need to say so. Only we know that the heart reacts quickly to any emotional change in the human personality. Its constitution changes continually according to the vigor and weakness of respiration, movement, exertion, sleep, and wakefulness. These all affect the heart. What did Rav Yehuda Halevi want to express by that beautiful aphorism? The Jewish heart was commissioned by God to feel the pain of the millions, to share the travail of the world, to be involved in the suffering of humanity. As a matter of fact, the Jew is involved in all crises and in all perplexing situations. The Jewish heartbeat, according to Rav Yehuda Halevi, belongs not to one person, but to the multitudes. The Jewish heartbeat is not the heartbeat of the I, but of the Tao, of the He, of the Day, of people one knows, and of people who one has never met. In other words, the Jewish historical experience, according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, is a universal experience. Shall I say, with your permission, a cosmic experience? And I have good grounds for that, to me, which will support my statement. The Jew prays not only for himself, and not only for humanity, but even for the moon. Once a month, the Jew prays for the moon. The Jewish experience is all-inclusive, all-embracing, sympathetic to all. We have asked before, who are those individuals with whom the Almighty negotiates and signs treaties as if they were not individuals but peoples? And indeed they are not people but peoples. Who are they? What is their role? I'll tell you what their role is. What the role of Israel, of the Jewish people, is vis-à-vis the world, those individuals. The role of those individuals is vis-à-vis the Jewish people. And if you want, I can write an equation שנוכי אוקי לישראל, כישראל אומס, שהוא כלייף שבאלוהים. These individuals, prophets, messengers of God, are to the Jewish people what the latter is supposed to be to the world at large, namely its heart. The Shluchei Kehil belong to the people, and the people belong to them. Their love is boundless, and their thoughts encompass all dimensions of time. Mordecai cried with a bitter and loud voice. That's what the Megillah told us. I would like to understand, is a loud prayer more acceptable to God than a silent prayer? Does God measure the sound waves? The answer is, the cry was loud and bitter because Mordecai was not a single person, but a people. His cry was the sum total of many individual prayers. Of the nation is always a loud one, of course. The same is true of Esther. When she fasted, the whole community fasted with her. When she was clothed in malchus, in royal garments, the whole community felt that salvation is just a few steps away. Mordecai was the nation, Esther was the nation. As Mordecai was the people, Esther was the people. You know who understood that? Not a stranger. Who felt it? Who intuited it? Jews, I hope they did. But who intuited it? Who intuits the significance and importance of certain Jewish institutions? You know who? Our enemies. That Mordecai is not just an individual, that Mordecai is an individual nation, person, people, was discovered by Haman. By Yves Be'inov, Lishleach Yod, במורדכי לפדי, כי יגידו לי, אס עם מורדכוי. Haman is blind hatred, intuited it. The Mordecai who defied him was not just an individual. Today is here, tomorrow is in the grave. Haman wouldn't have cared so much about an individual. It was not just a lonely, single, elderly Jew. Not just a lonely, single, elderly Jew has defied Haman. But Mordecai the people, Mordecai the nation, Mordecai the multitude. And if not Mordecai, someone else would defy him. ויבס בינו ושליח יוד במרדכי לבדי, כי גידולי אס עם חייפן מרדכי. That's why ויבקש אומון להשמיד אס כל היהודים אשר בחירים. כל היהודים just comprise one great מרדכי. Now, let me analyze the nature of the assignment which were entrusted to Esther and Mordecai. They were both charismatic personalities, both individuals, nations. Each one was an individual nation, an individual hyphen people. But Mordecai was a man, Esther was a woman. Man is a teacher. The woman is a disciple. Man initiates action. She finishes what man starts, what he started. He is the theoretician. She is the implementer. He thinks in abstract. She in technological terms. He is at times naive, very naive. She is practical, and she knows particularly, and that's the most important matter now, the art of cunning. But please, cunning, I mean cunning in the positive sense. Cunning is completely different from slyness, she knows the secret of a crafty and dexterous action. She knows how to engage in such action. Man quite often is a swimmer. The woman, very seldom. Mordecai, the teacher, the educator, sees the initiative. Moreover, his clairvoyant gaze foretold him what was in store for his people. He foresaw the great tragedy. It was not a sudden... He was not struck suddenly by the disaster. Mordecai, it's very strange when you read in the Gilead, Mordecai refused to leave the palace. He sat steadily at the king's gate, who Mordecai still, Yeshe Bishar HaMelech. Why? Why was he sitting at the gate? What was he waiting for? Why couldn't he, leave the gate and go to Beth Medrash and join his colleagues and stay here at least? You know why he was afraid to leave the gate? I understood it when I had, unfortunately, this similar tragic experience. He was afraid, he refused to leave the gate for fear that something horrible, something monstrous may occur during his absence. It is a strange feeling, Rachmana Litzlan, as if, and it's an absurd feeling, as if one's presence may prevent the disaster from striking. You know it's wrong. I experienced a similar kind of foreboding during the illness of Mrs. Olechi. I never left her sick bed. Why? Not that she needed me, she didn't need me. Because I knew intuitively that once, that if I will leave her, death will snatch her from me before I'll have a chance to return. Rachmana Litzlan, it happened like that on his Thursday, Tiny Sester, 6 years ago. His foreboding, Mordechai's foreboding, came true. His prescience was correct. Of course, he knew about it before it happened. When When you read in Gilu Mordechai Yoda, does not mean, Chazal say Beruach HaKedesh, does not mean that he knew after the decree was signed. And the Rotsim, Achashtronim, the couriers who were sent out, it was simple to know. Mordechai Yoda, Eskalashanasa means, he foresaw it before it happened. When disaster struck, he did not panic. The teacher does not panic. Clearly and objectively, he arrived at a conclusion. It's a strange conclusion. There was something which he couldn't understand. And finally, when the decree was signed and sent out to all the peoples, all the nations, he understood. What he couldn't grasp before, he suddenly arrived at the conclusion that Esther was summoned by the Hashpoche to play her part in the great drama of Israel warming, of the Jewish people and the nations. Suddenly, a great light went on, an illuminated event which he could not connect before. He couldn't understand Ahasuerus' madness to invite Vashti to appear before his guests. He couldn't understand the ruthlessness with which he punished Vashti later. He couldn't understand, and this was the most puzzling fact, Esther's ascent to the throne, the ascent of a young, poor girl, an exile, an immigrant, to the coveted throne, as queen of the Persian Empire, as queen of the far-flung Persian Empire. Suddenly, events which were unexplained before, or rather unexplainable before, began suddenly to fit into a historical frame of reference, into a historical pattern. And it began to make sense. He immediately realized that it is Esther's turn now, historical turn. She and no one else has been selected, or I may say elected, by the Hashpoche as the redeemer of the Jewish people. He was, and he knew, that the Herculean task is hers, not his. He may be initiator, but he will never implement it. He was not chosen. If he was not chosen, so what was the assignment which was entrusted to him at this hour of crisis, of distress? What assignment? The assignment consisted just of two simple performances. Two simple aspects. First, a very, what shall I say, classic and pedestrian flat task to apprise Esther of the events that transpired just a few hours ago. Secondly, this was the little more significant task, to make her realize that she and no one else is charged by the Almighty. What shall I say? This is a mission of impossible. uh, I'll leave out the word impossible. Everything is possible. Vision mission, which is the raison d'être for our paradoxical rise to kingship. And the mission actually justifies her sitting on a throne, on a strange and alien throne. He starts as educator, and he was her educator. He raised her. As teacher, was to watch over Esther and to inspire and influence her. And as I said, Mordecai was Esther's teacher for many, many years. He brought her up. He raised her. Now, because he became once again a teacher, a prophet. He was the small, still voice which comes from within, exhorting, preaching, instructing, and inspiring. At this initial stage of the game, before Esther accepted the assignment, Mordecai was the youth. The man is the leader, the woman the power. Man was teacher, the woman the disciple. The voice of God addressed itself to Esther through Mordecai. Mordecai was bold, aggressive, initiated action. He knew first, he conveyed the news to Esther. And that is the reason why Mordecai came into the inner city, and only there he cried bitterly and aloud. I'll ask again the question, why was this manifestation necessary? Must the prayer be exhibited in order to be efficacious? The answer is plain. He tried to draw the attention of Esther. Had he cried at home, Esther would not have been informed about the development. In fact, his calculations were correct. The news reached Esther quickly. He achieved first objective. The line of communications. The line of communications was opened or was established between him and Esther. And suddenly the scene changes. Roles are shifted. The main actor is demoted to a less significant prominent position, and the central role is turned over today until now, lesser figure. At this juncture, Esther took over. She became the master. Mordecai
DeFauer. This award is reported sponsored by your New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut Toyota dealers.
And the Toyota Bus Park right now is New Jersey's 287. Southbound Sound is very tough for over 2 miles coming in exit 55 in Wanaque. It's a flipped over Jeep accident still being cleared out of the way. Much further down the line going north on 287, you have some delays near Durham Avenue and Edison at exit 4. There's a crash in the process of being cleared. Checking up on the Jersey Turnpike, you will find delays on the Western Spur coming south of the 15W. Big old tractor trailer stall on out in the center lane. Stay with the Eastern Spur for now. And across the Hudson River, the tough ride is in the Harlem leaving town, about a 15-minute jam. From the end of the city, everything's still doing well, including the Lincoln Tunnel through the light raindrops here as they get the view from our 1010 Winds jam countertop, the Panasonic Palm Quarter billboard. Greensboro Bridge still crowded on the lower level back out to Queens, but a stalled car's been cleared. Stay with the upper level or the Midtown Tunnel. And at the 1010 Winds transit desk, we do have some flight delays now. Newark Airport, 45 minutes on departure, scattered arrival delays. LaGuardia, scattered arrival delays. Things are still running well at Kennedy Airport. An alternate side will be in effect for tomorrow. The shadow traffic watch never stops. Another report in 10 minutes on 1010 Winds.
Rush to your Toyota dealer and check out the great deals on Toyota cars and trucks. Hurry to stay big. Toyota, every day.
In due time, 5:22. She'll be governor until her term runs out. Christy Whitman stuns both the GOP and the Democrats by abruptly pulling out of the race for the Senate seat vacated by Frank Lautenberg.
This is just personal. This is me personally. I can't do that and be the kind of governor I want to be for the people of this state.
Whitman had raised more than $2 million in the Senate race after forming an exploratory committee back in April. A decision to bow out opens the door for a free-for-all on the GOP side. Thomas Giblin is the New Jersey's Democratic Party chairman.
This is a clear plus for the Democratic Party. I think for the strong Senate candidate, and I think that the feelings that people have had over recent years about the Democratic administration in Washington, you know, these are very compatible with the Jersey interest, that's definitely a more than even.
However, when it came to implementation, the woman is the master. The implementation of any plan is a technological feat which consists in the selection and employment of the most effective means for the sake of achieving a desired end. This is what we call cunning, which is the forte of the woman. Our sages said, "Bino yesero nit no leisho." The woman was endowed with a more incisive intuition and better practical judgment than the man. Esther became the main actor. Mordecai had to listen to her. Vayaver Mordecai, vayad kechel asher tikso ol Esther. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. If we should glance through the Megillah once again, we'll notice that there was a basic controversy, a basic disagreement between Mordecai and Esther concerning the proper course of action. What do I mean by that? I mean, you all know the Megillah, no, don't you? The Megillah is basically the best known book of the Bible, the best known book of the Bible. There was a basic disagreement, and Esther won. And she refused to listen to Mordecai, and she won. Mordecai held the view that immediate, spontaneous action on the part of Esther is inevitable. Esther, in his opinion, was supposed to appear before the king, of course taking the risk of being rejected and executed, and plead with him hysterically, immediately. He should spare the people. Love Yala Melech, Ulis Hanen, Ulovakis Kufon of Alame. Did Esther act like that? When Esther appeared in Dina Court and the king accepted her and let her touch the scepter, did she right away prostrate herself? Embraced his knees, hugged his knees, and asked for mercy? No, she didn't. This was the way Mordechai understood, but this was not the way Esther understood. Esther did not concur with Mordechai. She went to the king. However, all she did when she was received by the king consisted in what? In extending an invitation to the king to attend the banquet, which she was giving in his honor. Well, that was a Persian custom too, not only an American custom. Not a single word, not a single tear about the decree. Not a single word about the tragic fate of the people who was mentioned. Moreover, she ignored the whole issue even at the banquet. Even when the king had came to the banquet. And Vayomer HaMelech L'Esther V'mishk HaYayin Ma'asher Losech V'Bakashosech Ad Chatzi HaMalchus. What did she say? She didn't mention a word. She was procrastinating. Apparently, she was not sure. She was waiting for something. She delayed, and when the king asked her to tell him to tell him the nature of her petition, she delayed. She was waiting for something. For something to happen. What was she waiting for? What was she waiting for? In order to understand Esther's tactics and the reason for her disagreement with Mordechai, we must simply cast another glance at the events the way they are recorded in the Megillah. We may discover a new focus in the whole story. But I'm not going to write fiction or to write you a novel. I'm not a writer, I'm too old for that. What happened actually, sister? What happened, sister? What was the background of those bizarre events? What is the story we find in small print between the lines? I believe that the Talmudic interpretation would eliminate many dark spots and fill in many gaps in this story. Ahasuerus, according to the Talmud, who was not a legitimate heir to the throne, he was a plebeian. According to the Talmud, his father was a steward in the charge of horses for Belshazzar, the king of Babylon. Belshazzar was the father of Vashti. She was a princess. Apparently, he became king like Napoleon thousands of years later, by the virtue of his mighty sword. Like Napoleon, Ahasuerus was most probably a brilliant strategist, an excellent warrior. He destroyed ruthlessly his opponent and ascended to the throne. That's how the Talmud describes Ahasuerus. However, I'm not going to write a detective story here. There was apparently an underground movement, a resistance. How do I know, you'll ask me? How do I know? I'll tell you how I know that. First of all, there was no reason why people should not hate Ahasuerus. A very coarse, a very brutal person. The case of Dixon the Seventh, the two eunuchs, the bodyguard of the king, who conspired to assassinate him, is quite revealing. there were people in the royal palace who wanted to remove Ahasuerus from the throne. In fact, what I'm going to say here is already mentioned by the Malbim. In fact, the whole feast is a crazy feast. I mean, 180 days, 7 days, the year after a year of feasting and celebrating the whole feast was due to Ahasuerus' sense of inferiority and insecurity. In a primitive way, he wanted to buttress his rule and to assert himself and to strengthen his kingdom by exhibitionist method. He displayed his wealth and tried unsuccessfully to show off his beautiful queen in order to impress his vassals, friends and enemies alike. When we read the story, not the story, about the speech delivered by Memuchan, according to the sages, Memuchan was Haman, just a pseudonym of Haman. We don't understand, actually, Memuchan's speech. And the fuss he made about the probability of women's insurrection and revolution. I'm not afraid. What kind of a rebellion did Memuchan anticipate? What was he afraid of? Of a kitchen debate? The husband will be forced to do the cooking and baking, and the wife will go off to business. What was he talking about? Vayim azeh temanus or esporas modai v'chis or ha-melech וכדאי בזוי וכתב. What was he speaking? What was he talking about? And why was it included in the Megillah? After all, the Megillah is a part of the scriptures. Apparently it's very important. However, let us not forget that in antiquity the victor often married the widow or the daughter of the enemy or the enemy king whom he defeated in battle. It was a common practice. Such a marriage most probably was supposed to symbolize or to sanction the victory and sanction the right of the winner to the throne and everything else which goes with the throne. Everything was taken away, including the queen or the princess. Our sages tell us that Vashti was the daughter of Belshazzar, and the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Here. An aristocrat, a blue blood, who looked, of course, upon her parvenu husband, or parvenu nouveau riche husband, with contempt and hate. The Gemara tells us that when she refused to appear before the guests, at the request of Ahasuerus, she sent to him the following answer. Bara Uraiche, I'll read it in Aramaic. Bara Uraiche de Abo. Abo le Kabel Alte Chamre Shosev le Rove. Vahai Gavri ishtate de Chamre. Thou, she addressed Ahasuerus, son of my father's steward, in charge of the altar. My father drank wine in the presence of the thousands. And never got drunk. And that man has become senseless with a little bit of wine. This remark is characteristic of the patrician's disgust with the social climber who cannot hold his liquor. His liquor. Exactly. Couldn't Ahasuerus couldn't hold his liquor. The hate was mutual. Ahasuerus reciprocated. However, he was afraid to kill her because he thought that her presence at his side, the presence of the aristocratic princess, the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar and the daughter of Belshazzar, enhances his prestige and glory. That's why Ahasuerus was perplexed and did not know what to do after he was publicly abused and insulted by her. In spite of the fact that he was raging, he was not ready to execute her. When you read in Megillah, you see that Ahasuerus was perplexed. If Ahasuerus, I mean, knew what he has to do, I mean, he wouldn't have consulted the royal council. You know. Somehow, in spite of the fact that he was raging, he was not ready to execute her out of fear that the execution of the aristocratic queen might precipitate a revolution. In his confusion, he consulted with the royal council. Otherwise, he would have issued orders all by himself, and he would not have, I mean, consulted the council. Ahasuerus was never reluctant to destroy a person who stood in his way. There was no need for the Muchan speech, advice. Ahasuerus apparently was perplexed. He didn't know what to do. The Muchan warned, and Ahasuerus was ready to be lenient and forgive her. Memuchon apparently warned Ahasuerus that leniency vis-à-vis a queen who mocked the king publicly is a greater risk than swift punishment. Her refusal to appear and the insulting words she uttered might serve as the signal to all captive women who will be joined by the underground to rise against the king. Memuchon was not concerned because every official in Ahasuerus' empire married the daughter of the enemy official at equal rank. So the women were not just wives, they were captives. Memuchon was not concerned over a kitchen revolution or a debate, but of a real revolution in the Persian Empire. I am certain, cannot take an oath, but I am pretty certain, that Haman's promotion to the office of Prime Minister was due to Ahasuerus' paranoid fears. Haman was to Ahasuerus what Beryl was thousands of years later to Stalin. I'm serious about it. Our sages said, Memuchon zeu Oman. Memuchon is the pseudonym of Oman. And it was in the interest of Oman to keep the king in a state of nervous tension and restlessness. It was in the interest of Haman to magnify the danger and drive the king to insanity. Beria, as Husek tells in his memoirs, whether the memoirs are authentic or not, I don't know. But anyway, it's a good book. As Beria tells in his memoirs, I mean not Beria, Husek, Beria used to do the same to Stalin. So why did Haman do it to Ahasuerus and Beria to Stalin? Because a secure and sane king could not have tolerated a brute like Haman. a sick, frightened king relied on Haman. As a matter of fact, the appointment of Haman followed the Bigson Vaseresh episode. ביום המוערי ומאוד חיישי בשער המלך בקסון ובשרש לשני שורי שעשה ואיבח שמוספחו במלך החשברש ואיבור הדובר למוד חי ואתה הגנס כל המלך בשם מוד חוי ואיבור כשדובר הימוצי ואיתור לשני המלאיץ ואיקוץ בשם פדיבר יש היומים ולפני המלך הורד הדובר קרי יקצת הסברך ואת יוקן רי דרדוני פועל ואי אחר הדבור המלך גידל המלך החשברש לסומן ואי אבוז אפוינטט. After I forgot the name now, he was the governor of Petersburg, was killed, was assassinated. Even this absurd law, which Esther mentioned, begins to make sense. If we see it against that background of a paranoid king, asher komis liyisho, asher yovei alachot terapnis, asher lei yikorei achas dosi lohomis, makes no sense. It was a security, a safety measure. The palace, certainly palace ground, were closely guarded. Whoever clandestinely, surreptitiously, penetrated the Vienna court, was taken for a conspirator and executed. It's very simple. There is no doubt that Haman's indictment of the Jewish people before Ahasuerus aimed at arousing in Ahasuerus suspicions concerning their loyalty to the throne. The so-called Bill of Particulars, which Haman presented to the king, contains either two or three charges. First charge, Yesh Le'am Echad. It depends how you translate the word Echad. You may translate the word Echad, there is a certain people. But you may also translate the word Echad, there is a unique people or a united people. It means the Jews are united. It's an old complaint against the Jews. Number one. Number two. Mifuzor umfeirot benu amin. Scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of thy kingdom. Second charge. Third charge. Vedaseyem shenis mikolom. And their laws are different from those of every people. Two questions rise. Why should the king be concerned with the dispersion of the Jews throughout his empire? What kind of a complaint is that? The Jews were indicted because they were dispersed and scattered all over the far-flung empire. So what's wrong with it? Second, why should the king mind the unique Jewish laws? The Megillah has emphasized many times the polyglottic and multinational character of the empire. It was polyglottic, when they used to send out mail, the banner was not written in Persian. In Persian for the Persians, but for all other peoples, I mean, the mail was written in the vernacular. The latter, I mean, the Persian Empire, who was not a homogeneous, but a diverse community. So what's wrong with the people who professes a singular faith? There was no religious persecution in Persia. Persia resembles, in that regard, Rome. Rome didn't care about it, the cultural diversity of that empire. All Rome demanded its political allegiance. The answer, I believe, is simple. The Jews, since they have outlandish mores and strange customs, a unique mentality, and an incomprehensible outlook on the world, you can never guess what their attitude toward our institutions is or will be the next day. They are simply unpredictable. If you see a freakish type, unique, singular, you will say he's unpredictable. You don't know his reactions and his motivations. One cannot gauge, Heyman said, the psychological reactions and motivations of the Jew. Now he is loyal, tomorrow he might plot or conspire against the king. So they are not reliable, they are not trustworthy. I mean, usually when you suspect a stranger, why do you suspect the stranger? Because you don't know him. And if you don't know him, you don't know his reactions and motivations, his manner of responding to stimuli, to phenomena. That's what Haman said to the king. You don't know, you can never be sure about the Jews. Today perhaps they're perfect. But what will happen overnight, no one can predict. Secondly, Haman says, very clever, if the Jews should decide to plot and to join the underground, then I am afraid the king will be confronted with a menace of gigantic proportions. The danger will be great because of two reasons. First, they are a united, well-organized, and disciplined people. We still hear this kind of complaining. They are clannish, extremely obstinate, yeshnei amechos, the unique people. Second, due to their dispersion and ubiquity, wherever you cast a stone, you find a Jew. The Jew will carry the message of rebellion throughout your entire empire. There are Jews in every town, village, hamlet, and city. It would be humanly impossible to control and watch them. They are in contact with all races and peoples, populating the far-flung land of your majesty. An insurrection by the Jews will spread quickly like wildfire. We all be helpless. Suppression of such a revolution, rebellion, borders on the absurdity. Under such circumstances, I recommend your majesty that the Jews be exterminated. Very logical. Ve'lamelech en shever la'anichem. It is against the best interest of the king to permit such a status quo to continue.